Accession number 17621, William Ver, Reel 9.
Mr. Ver, Reel 9. We've finished with Hospital Hill, Mr. Ver, and you've had your day two's rest. What happened to you next?
Well, we set off, and I think we actually set off from Hospital Hill. It was a hill, certainly a hill, I'm sure. And we was doing a night approach march. We didn't know where to at the time. And we set off, and I can always remember passing on the hill there. We were all in single file. It was that dark. We had to hold each other's bayonet scabbards, like elephants holding each other's tails. And I can also remember passing a shell that mustn't have exploded. It must have been from one of the ships. It looked like a 15-inch shell or something like that, and it was just laid on the top of the ground as though it had bounced and never exploded. And I always remember passing that. Anyway, as I say, it was pitch black. I don't think there was a moon. There couldn't have been. And there were frequent stops, as though the way we were leading us wasn't quite sure if we were in the right direction, but we kept stopping. And each time stopped, everybody seemed to go straight to sleep. Everybody was that worn out with the previous week or 10 days or whatever it was. That it was more or less constant living on your nerves. So every halt there was, you had to more or less kick them awake. In fact, one time I thought somebody had been smoking and dropped a cigarette, and I tried to stamp it out until I realised that it was a glowworm or something. Anyway, we carried on, and we kept going on, stopping and having to wake people up to get going again. And eventually we crossed through, went through a farmyard, and then we crossed a road, and then we went and started up this hill. There'd been nothing, no reaction from the Germans at all, and we went up this hill up to the top, and we more or less planted ourselves up there. And then when it got daylight, as I say, we were up. We were up this hill, and we was up there all. I'm not sure how long we was up there really, but I know we ran out of water. And there was a shrine at the top of that hill, like a cross on, and underneath it was like a pool that was stagnant with green algae on the top and all kind of thing. That was the only thing there was to drink. So we tried some of that. There was a artillery forward observation officer with us. I don't know who it was, whether it was Major, I don't know. Of course, they had a stove, and so we tried making some tea out of this water on his stove, but it wasn't very nice. So when it got dark, I and another lad, we collected the water bottles, and we decided we'd go back down, cross this road to this farmyard, and get the water, fill the water bottles. And we went down, but we got down to this road, and it was parked. There were all kinds of vehicles parked there, German transport. I don't know if there were any tanks. I didn't really stop to see. I didn't walk around them to examine them. We come back up the hill. Can't get down there. So we finished up, we sent another lad down the opposite side of the hill. There was a village at the bottom. Now, I don't know whether that village was actually, what they call it now, that hill? Oh, I can't remember the name.
Wasn't Dragoni or something? A small village?
It could have
this
been.
This is the Vietri Defile.
It's Vietri Defile, that the action, but this hill we was on was the... Ooh. A 0.600. I don't know the name of it. I more or less went by the name of the other village. Anyway, I still can't remember that. But anyway, a chap went down there, and he came from Batley, which is not far from Bradford. Him and another lad, and they came back up with a big struggled up the hill with it. A big carboy, glass carboy, full of water. How they got up the hill, I don't know. And he told us that the villagers had said that the Germans, where they'd filled it from this well, and the Germans were, they were using the same well, getting it at the night. And that's all the action that we saw. The other companies, I think, saw more action. But the next thing after that, I think the way was through to Naples. I think that was no less the gateway. I think that that particular action was the one that said open the that defile up to the through to allowed progress to Naples. Then, but as I say, our company, I can't remember us firing any shots or anything like that up there. I think we just occupied that hill. We approached it at night, and occupied the hill, and I can't remember our particular company doing anything else there until the action was over.
Colonel Preston had actually ordered the attack silent.
Ah.
He hadn't asked for artillery support.
That's right, yeah, but it was silent.
So this is why it was a quiet falling, no doubt.
Yeah.
And entirely successful.
Yes. As I say, we didn't have to fire at all. We didn't do any. Our company did. I don't know what the other, because I think the York and Langston, somebody else were around there as well, weren't they? But I think that was the last action that, more or less, what you could say at Salerno. Because I think after that, next thing we were doing, I think we were on our way through Naples, I think.
You went in Naples. What
passed through it?
What was it like there? Were the people out for you?
Oh yes, they were out throwing apples and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Pleased to see you.
They seemed to be. Yeah, seemed to be. But we just passed. We were in trucks and we just almost drove through it to positions north of it. Yeah. Because our next objective there from there, I think, was the Volturno. Then.
What are your memories of the Volturno action? Crossing the Volturno.
Yeah, well, prior to crossing.
Was this again a silent attack? No. That.
Well, it certainly wasn't silent as far as the Germans went. I can't remember. We may have not used artillery. I can't remember a lot of artillery fire. I know we practiced in a village. I know all these names of the time, but now I can't bring them to mind. We're practicing with these boats, which are sort of walked to the river, but to carry these assault boats, which were big, horrible, heavy wooden canvas things, and which are sort of, we're going to cross on these boats anyway. When it happened the night it happened, we approached the river. And we couldn't. I don't think we launched a boat at all. We couldn't. And we were under fire, more or less. Say, we were mainly machine gun fire from the other bank, and the Germans were shouting out. They knew we were there, like. And we finished. We couldn't get a boat across. I think we got a boat launched, but it was pretty fast flowing, and I think it was swept away. A few were drowned. And we finished up. We crossed. By rope, somebody must swim in and got a rope across, and we pulled ourselves across on that.
Was it deep, the water?
Well, you couldn't touch the, your feet didn't touch the bottom, so it was. So we got across with that. Maybe someone got across on boats higher up or lower down, I don't know, but we didn't. We went across, as I say, on a rope. And then when we got to the other side, as I say, there were mainly machine gun fire. And then we got across and we finished up on a big embankment, like a ditch at one side of it, and this embankment, and we were in this ditch, and the Germans must have been on the other side of this embankment because they kept putting small attacks coming over the top. And took coming down, but there were with some chaps on the top, and they were catching them before they sort of got through to us. So they didn't push us off or anything like that. We sort of stuck it out there.
And were you being shelled at this point in time?
No, we weren't. No. I think we were being mortared either. I don't think it was just mainly machine gun fire. and rifle fire. There was some behind us. Where we got into this ditch, there was some houses, probably 500 yards behind us, and they were firing from there as well. So they were obviously in their houses, but it was only like rifle, right, small arms fire. There was no mortar fire off, as far as I remember. That's just how your memory serves, isn't it?
You say the Germans were shouting at you when you were on the riverbank and they knew you were there. Were they shouting in English or in German or what?
Oh, they shout in English, come on Tommy, and all this sort of thing, you know.
Do you shout back?
You've had your chance. Well, we don't know, because you don't want to give yourself away where you are, you see. I mean, I don't think they actually knew where we were, but I suppose they hoped if we fired back and all that, they'd good spotters, and we tended to try and not give our position away, I suppose. Plus, when you're halfway across the river, you don't feel like shouting back there when you're struggling across. So.
What were you carrying with you? What had you on your backs?
Well, your usual field service fighting order, which is your everything you normally have, your pouches with ammunition, your weapon, your small pack with all your gear in, your shaving kit, your towel, soap, mess tins, emergency rations, probably a tin of corned beef, packet of biscuits, and a block of chocolate, which you aren't supposed to touch under dire threats of being shot, sort of thing. You've got death's door before you touch that. And, of course, your entrenching tool, water bottle, bayonet.
Was it quite heavy?
Fairly heavy. Your heaviest things, I think, were your ammunition. I had 10 magazines of Tommy gun ammunition. They were fairly heavy. And of course, the lads also had Bren gun magazines, which I don't know whether they had two in each pouch or three in each pouch, which filled with ammunition, each held 28 rounds. So it all adds to weight. Then you've your rifle, they had the rifle, and somebody had the Bren gun, of course, and the Piat. I got to get that across. I don't know how I got that across. But they were all to get across.
Was it wide, the river?
Fairly wide. It was dark. I've been there since, and I've gone across it in a bus. and you just go, you're across, you know. Oh, it didn't that wide, but it seemed wide. It seemed wide that night.
And you'd be moving forward with your platoon then, your section with the rest of the platoon?
Yes, you always moved as a platoon.
Where's the commanding officer of the platoon in relation to his sections?
Well, you probably have a leading section. Maybe two leading sections, and then perhaps platoon headquarters, and then the third section. It just depends where, you know. It depends how you know, what the place is like, and how you're fixed as to where he is. But he always travelled with the platoon. Your platoon sergeant, you see, is with him as well, and the platoon commander, and his runner, his Batman. Any wireless operator, you see. Although, didn't you really have a, I think, well, the company, the big sets used to be just company sets, I think. So he could probably after the first section, after the first two sections, he could put his platoon headquarters there, yeah.
Did you lose any men yourselves, you know, in your own platoon, your own section? Did you lose any men crossing the Volturno and taking up this position at the ditch?
I don't think so, no. No, we didn't lose any actually crossing, as far as I can remember. We did lose some after we got into this ditch. We lost some, a couple of lads that was on the top. That was on the top of this embankment, so that we're looking over the, so they could cover the other side. and I think they were shot from his houses behind. So there were two there, I think. But I don't think there was any. I can't recall anyone else at the time.
Moving forward in the dark like that, what again was your role? Obviously, you're leading your section. But what was it? Was it to keep them in position?
Well,
what are you doing as you're going?
You mean crossing the river?
And moving forward.
Well, crossing the river, there's nothing much you can do. All you can do is try and get across yourself. And
but once you've got the other side.
When you've got the other side, you've got to sort of make sure you've got them with you. And if you're being given any direction as to which way to go, well, you do that. Or you're probably a company commander, your platoon commander would gather you together and say, right, we're going across this way, and you'd follow him. You sort of wouldn't do anything off your own bat, unless you had specific orders to do that. You know, they might say, take your section and try and take that house or something like that, then you'd do it. I mean, even then you're being given the order to do it. But in a case like getting across the river there, you had to sort of get together and move. You couldn't sort of move piecemeal, really, because you didn't know who was there, where they were, really, so...
You came out of the line after the Tiano. What happened to you then?
When we went to Carinola on rest, and I think it was at that time we came out, and I was feeling terrible. I didn't want anything to eat. Just couldn't stir myself to do anything. We were in a schoolroom in Carinola, and. I just felt lousy, and the medical sergeant was coming round, and I reported to him, and he took a urine sample, and the following day they had me into hospital, and apparently, as I found out since, there was an epidemic of... jaundice anyway. It's apparently we're going around like wildfire at that time in amongst the troops, and that's what I got anyway. And so I was in hospital, I think about a fortnight. Or did I go? I went to convalescence then, I think, too. That's right. I went to Sorrento, which was very nice, to a convalescent camp
Was it a military hospital you were in?
Yes, military hospital.
And how did they treat you there?
Oh, fine. Only thing was, you were on a restricted diet, with it being hepatitis A, I think it is. I don't know. It was all, you'd no fat, it was a fat-free diet, so it was all boiled chicken and that sort of thing. It was okay. And gradually... got over it, and they sent me to Sorrento on the coast.
And what was it like?
Oh, that's a lovely place. Been back this year on holiday, actually. And I was there at that time when... It was that time, and I was there, and there was a chap from the Hampshires, and he'd just come back down, and he was talking. He'd just come down from the line. He said, "Oh," he said, "it's heads down, arses up there." I says, "Why?" He says, "Come up a couple of place there. Call it." I think they call it Casino or something like that. I said, "Oh, yeah." And that must have been the first. But they were just approaching up at Casino. Anyway, I was only there a week or two. I had Christmas there.
What did you do with yourself when you were in Sorrento?
Nothing, really. It was just a matter of getting yourself fit. You could go out, went down to meals. We're in one hotel, and we went down to another hotel for meals and that sort of thing. With Christmas, spent Christmas there, actually. Very nice. I can't remember just where I rejoined the battalion from there. But it was just after that that we, I think it was up around a place called Sessa Harunka. And we was in Sessa, and I think we were reserve company at that time, and we'd write good night out at Sessa. I got drunk too much wine, and I think the wine there, a little wine shop in the village, and I think it was 22 lira a bottle was the wine. And at that time, the lira was 400 to the pound, so it was about 3 pence a bottle. And we was up too much, and there was a chap there called Holder, Bill Holder. He was a good pianist, and there was a piano in this place where we were billeted, and he played with Right Good Night, sing song. And then the following day, we had to go up this Calabrito Valley. It was on the side of the in front of us at Sessa, there was a mountain with a monastery on the top, and that was Monte Camino. And I don't know, it was 56 Divar, the Guards Brigade that was up there. And we were sent to the side of this massif to sort of give protection. And it was like, it was up a valley, and that's where we came under fire. It was at night when we went up there, and it was a terraced hillside, and I was actually in my section on the top terrace, and I had to dig in. We were under machine gun fire, so they had us digging in. They were on the opposite side of this valley. And straight away, and he was in a terrible state. And we dug in eventually. And I was an odd man because I had an even number of men in my section, so they paid off to dig their trenches, which left me on my own to dig one for myself. All I could do was dig a long one so I could just get below ground, laid out flat. And anyway, the following morning they started to mortar us from across the valley, and quite a few casualties, and that was when Major Balance was killed. He was our company commander at that time, Major Balance.
What was he like?
He was a gentleman type of officer, yeah, nice chap. He was killed there. We were there all that day. I say we'd been mortared, and there were quite a few casualties. We were there all day, and when it got to the evening, we were told to withdraw back to some trenches that we'd already passed the night before, some German trenches, a group of trenches. We were told to be pulled back to those. And I know this Bill Holder that had been playing the piano the night before, I helped him back. He'd been hit in the head. And he just died as I was. He died as I was helping him back. And there were a few others that had been killed outright there, including Major Balance. So we came back with due to these trenches, and we were in those. And then it come on absolutely bucketing down the rain. It was terrible weather. And it just churned it all to mud. The slip trenches were half full of water. You were just sat in them and trying to get a cigarette going, but couldn't. And then they started mortaring us. But of course, they knew the exact range for these trenches because they were the ones that they dug. When they withdrawn higher up the valley, they knew the exact range, and they were dropping these bombs all around. And luckily, half of them were duds. They weren't exploding, whether it was because of the soft ground, it was because it was all mud. Although a chap in the trench next to me, about just a bit farther from where you are now, he must have sort of sat up and above the level, and a bomb exploded and killed him. And his mate that was in with him were badly wounded. He come from Huddersfield, just down the road, and he was badly wounded. And then our platoon officer, Mr. Smith, who the chap I was talking about came from the East Yorks. And we pulled back then, a bit farther back, not a lot farther back, and then we pulled back onto an embankment just round the corner from the entrance to the valley, so that it was sort of out of range of where the Germans were. We tried to make some tea, I tried to get some tea going, and told the lads to dig into this embankment, you see, and I'd get some tea. Still raining. I managed to get a ration box to as a shield and got a Tommy cook, and after about three tins of this jelly, petroleum jelly sort of thing, I managed to get the mess tin of tea boiling through the, it's all powder, you see, sugar, tea sugar and milk powder, which we got in tins, threw that in and made some tea. These, the lads in the meantime had dug a cave, and there's all roots stuck through that from top. So I took this tea in and gave him some. Just about to zinc mine, and a clod of earth dropped from the roof of this silly straight into it. It took me about an hour to get the water boiling. So from there, we then went back up.
Just before we go further, you've been through a very heavy experience of mortar shelling. How do you stand that?
Well, it's awful. I don't like. I never did like mortar shelling because they come straight down. You can be in the slit test, but it can drop in right in with you. Whereas a shell at least comes down at an angle, and unless it's got to be a bullet, so a direct hit. Well, I suppose a mortar bomb has, but there's always that feeling that they're coming straight down, and it's the thing I never did like mortar fires at all. Well, I didn't like shell fire either, but. Mortified, it was worse to me, it was.
Do men's nerves go under prolonged bombardment like that? Is there a point when they snap?
Well, I think if you're under a long bombardment, I think you'd go mad eventually, go off your rocker. Unintentionally, I don't suppose, as I say, every man has a different breaking point, and some go before others, and that's why I say, you could never point the finger at anyone because he'd reached his breaking point. Yours might be just a little bit farther on. It might be another half hour, it might be you. So you do tend to be on the brink quite a lot, and it takes all your striving to prevent yourself from going to pieces. As I said before, I've been on the point of it a few times, and I suppose everybody else had. When you feel like letting everything go and gabbling and screaming, giving it away sort of thing, and just letting go, and you sort of just manage not to, you know, until next time sort of thing. Some certainly do.
Do men shout or scream in these conditions?
No, I don't. More or less just got their heads down, really. You just curl up in a ball and hope nothing comes your way. Yeah, I always used to undershell, well, any sort of fire like that, if I was in the slip tent, yeah. There's nothing you could do. You can't sit up and see what's happening. You've got to keep down. And I used to always lay on my left side and put my hands between my legs and my tin hat on the top and hope for the best, and I just felt I was protecting myself a little bit. Probably wasn't, but I just felt that bit more secure, like. And as I say, if it was a prolonged bombardment, I could feel like I'd just go to sleep.